given our technology issues, we're going to get Dr. Henry Deutsch, who's a practicing orthopedic surgeon in the Detroit Medical Center. He's the chief of the sports medicine clinic and fellowship. And do you have the answer? It's up there. Here we go. And he's going to talk to us about get in the water. Can I do it?
So good morning, and it's great to see you all here. There's a Dr. Kyle that unfortunately was unable to be here, but his talks had part one and two of orthopedics from head to toe out of the ED. And I'm saying, good gosh, I'm the orthopedic surgeon, what am I going to talk about? And so here we are talking about some of the things that we see even in orthopedics has to do with getting out of the water. I'm a sports trained guy, and what I do essentially is extremity surgery, soft tissue extremity surgery. So I'm going to kind of run through some things that might be of interest for you all as far as being here in the islands, as well as when you go back home. Hope you enjoy it. So no disclosures, but this is actually these large whale sharks that you can swim with. They're very harmless, and I had the opportunity to do this in Hawaii. We're actually, you're in a boat, and as the airplane in contact with you, constant communication, they say, we identify a shark, and they kind of swim by it, and they jump in the water. Like seven people jump in the water and start swimming with these sharks. It's the most amazing thing if you've not ever seen or done something like that. In orthopedics, there's various things that can cause injury in the water. Obviously, there's mechanical objects and devices, such as watercraft and recreational devices we'll talk a little bit about, as well as marine contact, these bite stings and even blunt contact. Swimming injuries as well. We'll talk a bit about that as well, whether it's in the pool, lakes, quarries. We know about some of the more significant things that could occur, particularly in quarries, as well as the ocean. And always to think in your mind about, particularly with the children, as well as ourselves, depth, current, and in sports, we think about fatigue fairly significantly. If I start with the recreational device injuries, the use of recreational devices, particularly jet skis, are on a big time on the rise. And this is just a 30% increase from the 80s till the mid-2014s. And same thing, use of surfing, surfboards. Obviously here in Hawaii, surfing is quite big. We have the East Coast and the West Coast, particularly the United States. But all of this is on the rise. And so with it comes specific injuries. And if we go first to the watercraft injuries, these are can be quite significant. University of Miami study, retrospectively, 127 people admitted over the time of 04 to 17 with a mean age of 29. Half of them were orthopedic injuries, 100 fractures, mostly upper extremity, spine, acetabulum, pelvis, and ICU admissions, about a third. This was a 54-year-old who lost a leg on one side, a fracture on the other. Another study out of Tampa, Florida, retrospectively as well, age 33 average, 146 patients, and imagine 216 fractures in 146 patients, 16% children. And here, more than half lower extremity, pelvic fractures, open fractures, and of the open fractures, 16% went on to amputation. This is very significant. A good friend worked at NASA. One of his buddies was out with his two sons in their 20s on a jet ski. Dad and one of the sons was idle. The other son come behind him and basically couldn't stop and killed dad. And these things happen. And whether you all have seen or not seen these. And there's a lot of these boats in operation now. It accounts for particularly the watercraft. A quarter of all marine injuries, even though they're only about 10% of registered boating. It's 18% of all water collisions, and the top speed of some of these are 80 miles an hour. And obviously all of us, when we're on vacation somewhere, we see these things are being just off the beaches and go for a ride. They have their risks. Why is it? The thing about here is that if you look, and why did that NASA doc get injured, is if you look here, of those who are aware of that, the water gets sucked into the machine, it gets shot out. And the problem is, when you're riding a car, you know you get a brake and stop. And what happens here is people are goofing around and they think they kind of spray you, like maybe you're skiing down a slope and spray some water at you, but they can't stop. They don't realize you have to actually give it some more gas, if you will, to get it controlled. They kind of slow down, they're trying to slow down, and they lose control of the vehicle. And so that's really what happens. I personally have seen pelvic fractures, upper and lower extremity fractures. I mean, this is very significant stuff. So it's something to be aware of as we're raising our kids, to make them aware as well about the safety of using these vehicles. What about surfing? Surfing is safe overall. Estimated about 1 to 3.5 injuries over 1,000 days. So that's a few years worth of boarding. But most of these are cuts, concussions. Striking your own board is number one. That basically the wave hits, you get torn away, hit you in the head, face, or wherever. And there's also bites and stings from marine life. And actually, if you go on the news, you can see all the surfing that's going around here with the waves coming up with all the storms. And you would have, gosh, probably 50 or 60 people that are almost on top of each other. And how these things don't happen and more people get hurt every time they're out there is beyond me. But most of the boarding, like here, it says 53% or over half are from hitting your own surfboard. There's a percent of hitting other surfboards and waves and things of that sort. Actually, even in the ocean floor. And so most of these injuries occur in the head, face and head, and the lower extremity is around here in the foot, actually, catching somewhere on the foot. This is the reef tattoos. Reef tattoos are actually hitting some of the coral below you and actually scraping yourself up. And that could be quite significant as well, and infectious potentials as a result of that in marine life that may actually be embedded. So be aware that can occur as well. This is a group of family that got together over a holiday. It was actually during the Christmas holidays in South Carolina. And that family happens to be mine. This is my brother and some of my and my son and his kids up in the upper left. And we're out there, we're gonna go surfing. My son's into surfing now. He's on the West Coast, Australia. He's now on the East Coast, the military. And so the silly thing is that we're surfing now quite a long period of time. I'm an old guy, it's fatiguing, you know, and don't kind of give in to that. Keep going, the waves getting better because it's getting darker. And here we are, like a bunch of yo-yos. Here it's getting dusk at night. I'm gonna talk about sharks in a little bit. I mean, that's not the time to be out there. If you see way in the distance, there's actually a reef. I don't know if this thing is showing that or not. Sorry. There's a barrier of concrete stone in there that's a barrier for the shoreline. Well, good old me, who happens to be on anticoagulation at the time and now, but hits this thing and the waves are just pounding against me. And luckily, that's all I came away with. But all this stuff is very possible to anybody, anytime. It's just being aware. You want to try these things and do these things, just be aware of what you're doing, what the risks may be, what could occur. What about the animals that are in the water? So here we hurt ourselves with the machines we have and the boards we bring and things of that sort. There are a number of these, and we're aware of a bunch of them. I'm going to talk about some of the ones that maybe be a little less aware of. You know they exist and what they can do and hurt you. Obviously, the venomous ones on the left side, the rays and the urchins. We're going to talk about the scorpion, lionfish, stonefish. And this thing in the front here, the pictures are weaver fish. They can bury themselves within the gravel and the sand at the base of the ocean. And the non-venomous ones, obviously the sharks, alligators, crocodiles, and things of that sort. So initial management, we were actually just in Mexico not too long ago, and there was somebody on the beach with a step on an urchin. They just happened to know they stepped on an urchin. Very painful. So you want to know what happened, like anything else. And if there's a concern about any of these spines being stuck in you, you get an x-ray. Sometimes they'll show up. If you're still suspecting such, and it's not showing up, and there's persistence of pain beyond what the normal, we'll talk about that, a consideration for ultrasound versus MR. Ultrasound obviously a lot easier for those who are familiar with that. The treatment, when you suspect the venomous type of these creatures, would be hot water immersion, if possible. The pain will persist, it's very significant, 30, 90 minutes, and there's a controversy whether regional anesthesia or not. But the reality is these things are all over, and whether here or anywhere back home. So I'm going to talk about these three, the stonefish, scorpionfish, and the lionfish, and show some photos in a second. But the most potent is the stonefish, and just get a feel for they exist. And the lionfish is probably the least and probably the prettiest. They kind of hang out at the bottom of the ocean, and most people get hurt just by stepping on them, whether you realize that or not. The immediate onset of significant pain, you can get lymphedema and swelling. And they grade these things, having erythema as a grade 1, bullae as a 2, and then a chronic ulceration around the puncture site as a 3. It's rare to get systemic symptoms. It's really treating this initially, minimizing the pain, again, getting any prickly stuff out of the individual, usually in the feet. And it's very rare, although it does potentially occur if a large amount of dosing is an individual to have hypotension, neurotoxicity, and very rarely death. And some consider it prophylactic antibiotic, cephalosporin. This is what a stonefish looks like. So it sits kind of at the bottom and can look like a stone, buried in here. And so these are what these little critters look like. And some of these may go snorkeling and they may go diving. It's kind of interesting just to go look for these things. The scorpion fish, I'm going to point out, they all have this, we're going to talk about this part, has on them these spines. And it's the spines that we worry about. These are the things that basically contain their venom. Okay, these things on the outside. Okay. And I think the prettiest ones are these lionfish. I think it's a menace actually out in Florida now as far as the ecosystems, but these lionfish, all of these things have their risks of invoking some venom. And how is it that works? Well, if you look here, this is actually the spine of these, and within the spine here is actually its venom, and it's a gel-like, and basically it gets stuck into the individual and actually releases that venom into the individual. And so, again, the most potent the stonefish we saw, and the least is the lionfish, but having some swelling of the extremity, obviously, if it is, to remove the restrictive clothing, foreign bodies can be also, again, to think about. Breaking off a spine in some of these fish can cause granulomas and secondary infections. So what's the bottom line of that? If you're going out there and the water is fairly close to some stony type of things, or you're in areas of a beach where you're not really aware of, just bring some protective shoes. These boat shoes are actually quite good, and they protect you from these particular events. Sea urchins. I'm going to spend a little time on that because we mentioned that earlier. I had recently just even been involved in seeing that. Not all are venomous, if you will, but the symptoms, again, very significant pain, erythemas, can with severe symptoms, hypotension, weakness, deafness. And if a lot of these spine can invade an individual, let's say 15 or more, there's a risk of even death. It would be unusual to have that many, but that's the risk. If it penetrates a joint, if somebody falls onto it, for a knee, for example, that basically needs to come out. And failure to do so, have persistence of infectious issues, synovitis, significant pain, and lead to secondary arthropathy. So that's key to be aware of. And again, the history and understanding where people were and what they did and what potentially had occurred. So again, the extremity management, as mentioned, is radiograph to begin with. Consider ultrasound or MR if you're concerned about retention of foreign body. These are, again, heat labile, so hot water immersion. And many of these long spines will break off into individuals, and just be aware. That's what we look for with the ultrasound. So you want to get removal of retained spine. Box jellyfish. I'm going to spend a little time on that as well. And the reason is it can be very mild and insignificant, probably more around here, a little less so than other places of the world, and particularly Australia is probably more significant. But I'm going to show you a little bit of that. Basically, these jellyfish and their tentacles can leave all these kinds of marks on people. And I'll mention multiple times, the severity and the outcome is dose dependent. The more that you get stung with or hit with, the greater the risk of having a very significant bad outcome. And the Hawaii jellyfish is less potent than the rest of the world. Does still have a painful sting. The toxin has dosed barbs. I'm going to show you that in a little bit and how this works. It penetrates the skin. The treatment here is to rinse it initially with seawater. People say that versus just regular sterile waters or just regular water that may be drinking from, just the seawater. And vinegar is really the belief at this time, although a lot of this is still controversial and being worked on, but vinegar is used then to deactivate the toxin. Do best you can to remove these tentacles and not to touch with your hands, obviously, because they still can release the venom. To remove with something. Some say a stick, a credit card, tape would be ideal, but who carries tape at the beach? But these are the things to try to get these things out. Apply ice, and the pain will be pretty significant. In areas where there's significant amounts of jellyfish, usually lifeguards have some of this stuff on hand. But again, it depends where you are and where you're playing. So just be aware these things can occur. The box jellyfish, why is it a box? Basically has 15 tentacles on four corners of its body. And so so if here you think of this as a square in a box, it's four of these long tentacles. And they basically be as much as 10 foot long as far as the fish itself, and 6 feet or so of tentacle. And again, it's the volume and the amount of contact that runs the biggest risk of an individual. It can kill a human as a result of its contact. There are things we're going to show you in a second called nematocytes. They fire upon touch. And there's hundreds of thousands of them per potential sting. And they hook like darts. And there could be as many as 5 billion of these nematocytes estimated on a jellyfish. So their goal basically is to do this to immobilize a prey and then be able to do its thing as far as survival in the ocean. So when we get in contact with it, it's not good for us. And these are what these nematocytes look like. They the tentacle here at the bottom. And along the tentacle, there's just quite a number of these things up and down the tentacle. We have this little area of the venom inside. The little trigger on top of this thing fires the thing out at over 30-some miles an hour into an individual or its prey or whatever it may be. And then it has a barb on there that locks inside of that. Sorry, this thing. And so the barb basically gets caught into the individual. That's where and it can actually continue to release some venom. Sometimes it doesn't, and that's the whole idea of trying to deactivate some of the toxins when somebody gets exposed to this. So you try the best you can with the vinegar to deactivate some of those toxins to minimize the potential continued injection of the venom of that has not been released. There have been studies. There's only 5 centers around the world that even look at these toxins and what they do to deactivate them, how to best treat them. Because again, a lot of them are not very potent, but some are very significant and can kill individuals. And so vinegar, this was actually a study that was done here at the University of Hawaii. Vinegar was believed to be some of the best toxins, and it's done various ways of doing these studies, and people around the world look at these things a little differently, but vinegar is still number one in hot water as far as trying to deactivate these things, initial management treatment. Why is it believed this occurs? Individual injury, the sodium, potassium, calcium channel disruption, rhabdomyolysis, sustained muscle contractions, I mean, some of the pain that occurs from this, and again, a very high and large dose of this thing causes dearrhythmias, hyperkalemia, osmotic deregulation. And so, and the toxins basically change the permeability of these cells. And that's what causes the serious injuries. And the ones in Australia, the ones that are very significant. We actually were in Australia. We were there when the boxfish were out. Signs everywhere in the state, in the county or the country parks about be aware of jellyfish. To be in the water, even to be in a kayak, we had to dress in a wetsuit. With hands and wetsuit and all kind of covering in case you fell in. There are little jellyfish everywhere. And so and those are the ones that basically are venomous and can kill you. It doesn't take much when you fall into a pool of these jellyfish. And we still went out in the kayaks. But again, they're helping us to know how to base manage yourselves in these environments. I'm not sure anybody else wants to go in those things, and maybe we're more adventurous in these stuff, but you got to be aware. This is an example of a 31-year-old, multiple tentacle stings. You can see him up and down the leg. Lost consciousness. Vinegar was applied. Went to the hospital within 15 minutes, CPR, ICU, and then survived. But this is the kind of stings that can occur where people can become fatal as a result. There are some antidote. There's question about its administration. This is a company that actually promotes this, again, in Australia primarily, but it is found in other parts of the world, in Thailand, Southeast Asia. There's 51 variety and species of these box jellyfish. I'm talking about the most severe ones, but we have them around here in Hawaii, and I'll talk about in a second, again, less venomous, and there's some in Florida as well. We've all seen them on the East Coast, even on the West Coast. Some questioned a vial IV. If you don't have access to an IV, at least three vials of this IM in and around the area of the stings. It's made from sheep serum, so obviously if there's any allergic reaction to anything that people have had in the past, and you store it at refrigerated temperatures. The whole idea is to block the tentacles from firing, and the tentacles, again, produce a hemolysis. Here's an interesting thing about this area, this meeting in Hawaii at this time of year. I thought it was kind of interesting. And this is kudos to the course moderators and developers of this. It basically, the jellyfish come out at certain times of the month as far as their mating and how they wind up on the beaches. And the way it happens is that at certain lunar and tidal conditions, so it's a certain number of days after the full moon, they'll basically mate, and there'll be tons of them out in the ocean, and then the tides come up, and they come over the rocks, and they bring them and land them on the beaches in the morning after the high tide, and the low tide recedes. So you wind up on the near the beaches in the low water areas. And so it's always after the full moon. Again, if you have access, like if you're going to be around this, I'd be in a wetsuit and trying to avoid these things. So in December, we have this meeting. These guys are so awesome that basically the full moon's towards the end of the month. This is the time of the, at the bottom, the yellow is the time of the month where these jellyfish are in their highest time because that's after the full moon, and these guys put the meeting way ahead of that. You don't have to worry about jellyfish. But anyway, this is for your information when you leave here, so kudos to the course coordinators. I threw this in because I'm blown away by this. This is a Texas A&M graduate who's here playing with alligators, and you're asking for trouble here. Infrequent attacks, over 81 years, you see there's 500 some encounters, 24 deaths. You just don't look for problems. And we personally know of people who have lost even animals as well as a kid on the sides in Louisiana swamp. So these things do occur. 90% of these attacks upper extremity, two times more than the lower. And it's the infectious potentials that we have to think about. Hydrophilia, gram negative, rapidly progressing cellulitis, bullet formation, and so fluoroquinolone, which is useful here, or third generation cephalosporin. I have to talk about this just because we're in the waters of the Pacific particularly, but understand that shark bites are rare. The attacks, that many worldwide, only 10% mortality of that number. Surfers are always mostly at risk. Many times they're there early in the morning and they kind of stay, like my own son, when the sun starts going down because it's pretty. Divers and swimmers. So know that the heightened times of attack are the summer and late afternoon evening. Murky waters, they have been known to be migrating as far as in the U.S. in the Mississippi River, 18 miles up the river, so they can be almost potentially anywhere. And they can occur in the extremities, bone loss, and fractures, as well as obviously hemorrhage. Over a 10-year period in all the Hawaiian Islands, 61 patients, this again a University of Hawaii study, at the Level 1 Trauma Center on the Big Island. And basically, it showed that most of these were around this area in Maui. 25% of them are tiger sharks, and only four fatalities, which were occurred at the scene. So at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu, of those 61 patients, 12 of those patients, they followed right to their center. 92% extremity injuries, almost half nerve injuries, quarter lower extremity amputations, and the key was bleeding control to save these lives. 75% of them, tourniquets or compressive dressings to try to save these individuals. In the meantime, to treatment was 60 minutes, so that's pretty significant. So at the site of management is really key. 87% are unprovoked of those 61 patients. Over half are in turbid waters. So when these animals can't really see and they see a lot of activity or even shiny things within the water become attractive to them, 13% are provoked. Some of these people are swimming with the sharks. And the other thing is not to have spear fishing and things where there's blood that's brought to the area. To be around that and around an area where there could be sharks, that again attracts the sharks. So the key is to keep away from them. So of the fatalities, one was bitten on the shoulder. One had amputation below his shoulder, another left leg amputation, and one was just kayaking and feet in the water and was fishing, which is a very unusual type of event. So the reason for death was hemorrhage, hypovolemic shock, as we would anticipate, and the key is to stop the bleed. Even a surfer can use their tether cord to use that as a tourniquet. Just keep that in mind as well. Safety tips to keep out of the water, dusk at night, out of the water with open wounds or is bleeding, murky waters, no high contrast, shiny clothing, no excessive splashing or erratic swimming. They're attracted to that. And if you see erratic behavior of other fish around you, for whatever reason, get out and swim and surf at patrol beaches, which is actually very helpful. Paddle boarding. People hear paddleboard, safe sport? It sure could be. The stand-up paddle boards, there's little data, online survey was done, 31 paddle boarders, 80% males, that all the injuries occurred when surfing the waves as opposed to paddle boarding on a lake or inland lake. Most of them sprains, some contusions, and 20% contact with their own board, almost like the surfers where there's 50% or greater, is 17% with their own board. This is actually my son, paddleboard in the ocean, took a stick and trying to take the wave, and the stick broke and got him in the knee. And we just happened to be there, we're mending to it and things of that sort. So that's one way of getting hurt, which I've never even heard of, and my own kid did this. But there's all kinds of ways of potentially getting hurt with everything that we do. So just be safe and be thoughtful. There's other ways of using the paddle boards and remaining very safe is using some aerobics or exercises on them. It's a thought, and this is being done around the country, even our own hometown. Swing prevention, talk a little bit that, and then finish up with some orthopedic issues of the shoulder I'm going to talk about, because that's a shoulder, swing shoulder, we'll talk about that in a second, is basically not to swim when you're tired and to be aware of your surroundings and environment. And probably the most common injury of swimming is the shoulder. We'll talk about it as far as impingement type of issues. But obviously on these beaches, these rip currents. So you're probably all fairly familiar with that, where the rip current comes down the middle, and we have to escape by swimming away from that. So too much swimming, too tired, fatigue, be aware. So shoulder pain. What is it about shoulder pain that most all of us have probably experienced sometime in our lives doing certain things? It could be nothing, waking up one day in the morning, and you did nothing that you can remember. It could be swinging a tennis racket overhead. It could be lifting, doing things, but swimming is very common. We see this in the office, so those are very competitive, particularly. So if you look under the acromion, there's a bursa that lives here, and that basically, we don't understand it completely how, and this is what I do for a living, we don't understand completely, but we know when that becomes inflamed and irritated, it causes pain. Your rotator cuff right below that can be intact, but you still have pain right above it. That's why we're going to talk about the rotator cuff in a second. But that could be where the stimulus of pain occurs. The only thing below that, then, is a capsule. So you have a capsule, a rotator cuff, and a bursa, and that's it in the shoulder. And so with that, if you understand that as you raise your arm up, the thought is that you capture this this bursa here as you raise your arm up, and it squeezes the bursa, and we take that for granted. That's a lubrication, if you will, but it can actually become inflamed like any other part of our body. Now, with that said, as you experience the impingement pain, any overhead activity will squash that area and cause pain. And so with the exam, what you're looking for is a full range of motion, forward flexion, abduction, and rotation. You're trying to make sure that they have strength and external rotation and resisted abduction. We're looking at the rotator cuff, actually, musculature, and I'll talk about that in a second. And those are the two things I'm looking for, and that's how I'm testing for rotator cuff function. Most of the injuries of the rotator cuff occur in the supraspinatus at the top. So as you resist abduction, you'll actually have what's called a drop arm, when you have a very large rotator cuff tear. A small one is insignificant, you'll still have good function. So 1 centimeter tear is irrelevant, but a 5 or more greater centimeter tear, you will not have the ability to sustain abduction and you'll have a drop arm. An external rotation, you're pushing out against the arm, and if it has nothing there to resist you, almost always, not only the supraspinatus, but also the infraspinatus is involved. So now you have both of these musculatures called a massive tear, and those are the ones we fix. Anything short of that, we don't have to fix. So we go on with that. You have then the thought of looking at shoulders. I first think of impingement because, again, I just want to show you this, that I think here's the impingement pain. I think of the impingement as pain. I think of the rotator cuff as function. Pain versus function. And so any of these diagnoses, even if dislocation gets reduced, where the capsule gets ripped and it comes back in, your rehab, as long as you have control of pain, normal function, it's all therapy. We never have to operate on those. All therapy. They're against your musculature posteriorly. The entire supraspinatus, a portion of the infraspinatus, those are the massive tears. Those are the most common. Those go out, I fix them. Okay? Those that we operate on is when you have this massive tear. It's all supraspinatus and a portion of the infraspinatus. So having a tear in and of itself doesn't make me want to operate. Because most all of us live long enough. In our 60s, we all have tears. And the young folks in their 20s and 30s will have partial tears. And that's just common. Okay? If you want to operate on somebody, you really want to operate, get an MRI. That's the bottom line. Because they're all going to show something that's abnormal, even though it's clinically irrelevant. So that's the bottom line of treating that. So with all these water sports that occur, whether it's swimming or doing other things, I've seen other stuff occur. I had a lady, 60 years old, on one of those banana boats. They're pulling you along. She falls off, dislocates her shoulder. Well, if you're in your 60s, 50s or 60s, and dislocate your shoulder, you are going to have a massive tear. That's been shown in our literature back 30 years ago. So, and that's been borne out in my practice over 30 years. You can have a tear, a massive tear. And what you look for, a dislocation, you all know this, a squaring off of the shoulder versus over here a nice rounded normal shoulder. And I just want to make one other comment. I always say this to ED folks, is that when you get an x-ray, for me, an AP and an axillary is the key. Because the axillary, you can see everything. If you get an AP and you just try to do a trauma series, you may miss it. And there's little tricks to be able to catch it, dislocations. But you shouldn't miss. You know the coracoid is anteriorly. If the humeral head is anterior, it's anterior dislocation, posterior dislocation, and there's no question. And anybody can hold onto an arm, IV pole, and get shot in an ED anywhere. So I just got to make that comment. Because even these posterior dislocations above here was what was taken in an ED, and people maybe missed this. You know, it's an AP, but the axillary shows you a posterior dislocation. In a sports office, we get what's called a Grashy view, but I don't expect that in an ER. So that's actually shooting down the humeral head. But the reality is, it can look the same, and even though it's supposed to be an AP. Get an axillary view. Those people cannot actually rotate because the humeral head's locked posteriorly. And the last thing, adhesive capsulitis, that first layer. If you sit with an impingement long enough and you can't raise your arm, you don't go there, you can't get your coat on, you can't do things, you sit, I go less, the joint capsule gets tighter, now you can't move it. And that sucker hurts. I mean, this hurts. This is the only thing, when I go to therapy with my patients, I say this is the only thing I do for a living, that you have to hurt to get better. You're ripping and stretching out the capsule. And if they fail and I go to the OR, I'm putting them to sleep and I'm ripping it all out to normal again. And they have to maintain it afterwards. So that's what that frozen shoulder or adhesive capsulitis is all about, and that's all therapy. So the bottom line here today is that there's lots of things to do here in Hawaii. Go have fun. So yes, you can get in the water. Be safe, but be aware and have fun. So thank you very much.